Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to those of you who are joining us from the West Coast, the East Coast, in Europe, in Israel, and beyond. My name is Hanan Weissman, and I am the newest member of the Sapir team, which I joined last month as the incoming director of the Sapir Institute. And I'll share more about that in due time. But I come by way of the federal government, where I spent the last 12 years working at the Department of State, a period of time at the Defense Department and at the White House. Now, I was at the White House where I was privileged to serve twice as the liaison to the American Jewish community in the final year of the Obama administration, then the first year of the Biden-Harris administration, and where I also had the great fortune of meeting remarkable individuals from around the country and around the Jewish world, including today's guest, Rabbi Deborah Waxman. Now, if you're watching this webcast, and I don't know if we still use the term webcast or not, but if you're watching this, there is a good chance you know that one of the hallmark features of Sapir is the deliberate attempt to cast a wide net, authors with multiple outlooks, perspectives that reflect different pockets of the Jewish community. Now, I'm not a betting man. You can ask any of my friends. I am not a betting man, but I presume that if you open up a copy of Sapir, and especially the current issue, Israel at 75, there's a good chance that you might find several essays, some that are enlightening. They make you think in ways that you hadn't previously before. Some that are enraging. You just thoroughly disagree with the premise and the viewpoint of the position. And some, which are enriching, they fill your cup, kosi rivaya. They speak to you in a deep and fundamental and meaningful way. Today, as I mentioned, we're deeply honored to have as our guest, Rabbi Deborah Waxman, who is here to discuss her thought-provoking and really soul-searching piece entitled Israel is in danger of losing American Jewry. Now, Rabbi Waxman is a leading and trailblazing voice in the Reconstructionist movement, having served as the first woman rabbi to head a Jewish congregational union and seminary. Rabbi Waxman currently serves as president and CEO of Reconstructing Judaism, president of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, and leader of the Reconstructionist Congressional Union. In 2016, Rabbi Waxman was named to the Forward 50 list of most influential Jews. And of course, she is a trained historian to boot. Now, Rabbi Waxman's list of accolades and honorifics and credentials is quite extensive. And it could take a while to go through them all, but I'm not going to do that. But if you will indulge, I'd like to add one more. This month, Rabbi Waxman then also became a writer in the pages of Sapir, for which we are deeply grateful and super appreciative that you're with us today. So Rabbi Waxman, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here, and I was really honored to be asked to write. And Hanan, your work on behalf of the Jewish community in the government was so impactful, and I'm so grateful that this allows us, that your new role allows me in particular and the Jewish community to really benefit from ongoing conversation and hearing your voice more independently and than your previous position allowed.
Thank you, Rabbi Waxman. You're right. I don't represent the red, white, and blue. You broadly represent the Reconstructionist movement. I feel like there's so much to unpack and discuss today. So let's dive right in. All right. Of all the essays in the current issue, yours really, it's the only one to focus exclusively on the nature of like the American Jewish experience with the Israel of today, right? It was an essay that was forged deliberately through the eyes of a non-Orthodox religious Jew, right? End quote. And, you know, I was taken by the way you construct the piece, also seemingly deliberately, off of a foundation of love for the country. And like why it's so meaningful for you to be Jewish in that country. And so I think before we expand out and delve into the potential for a wider schism between both communities, Israeli Jewish, American Jewish. I'm curious, just at a more personal level, what draws you to the country culturally, religiously, practically, and historically in your own life?
Oh, so very much, so very much. So you are exactly right. My beloved colleague, Felicia Herman, who I just saw her name pop up, when she invited me to write about non-Orthodox Jewish apprehensions about Israel, it was entirely clear to me right away that I wanted to begin with the place of Ahavat Yisrael, of the love that I personally feel and that so many diaspora Jews feel for Israel, that even as there is there is aspirations not yet fulfilled, even as there is critique, that it's from this deep grounding of love and connection and relationship. So I was able to boil it down to a few key issues. When I am in Israel, it is thrilling to feel the past and the present and the future all living so vitally and so accessibly all at once. Some of that has to do with being in the majority in Israel and seeing. My wife is a Jew by choice, and our first visit to Israel was over Hanukkah, and she could not get over the lack of Christmas decorations and the fact that we kept going to Hanukkah celebration after Hanukkah celebration. So that recentering, that reprioritizing, that is so qualitatively different. Even I've lived in very dense ethnic Jewish communities my entire life, and it is something completely different in Israel. So some of it has to do with just what it means to be a Jew in the Jewish homeland. Some of it also has to do with the accessibility. I had considered Aliyah many, many times throughout my life. And the first time was when I was 17 and I was there for a high school program. And my madricha talked about who was an Ola. She had made Aliyah and she had to drive from where we were outside of Tel Aviv to her home base, her home a couple of hours north to vote in an election. And it came clear to me how each and every voice matters in Israel, how much of an impact, and that this bold experiment in nation building and in democracy really depends on each and every individual. And that was in addition to into making the Jewish story, like the consideration of making the Jewish story be the central rather than the constant shifting back and forth of what it means to be an American Jew. It was also just the possibility of having that much influence, having that much impact in a youngish nation.
Right, and it feels different, you're saying, to live in that environment in a country vice in a densely populated city with Jews in the United States.
Oh, for sure. I mean, when I travel the country on behalf of the Reconstructionist movement, and I talk to folks in Jewish communities in the Midwest or on the East Coast, let alone those who are like there are two ways that that communities identify with the Reconstructionist movement. Some it's about because they are often in an urban center or suburban place where there are a lot of synagogues and they're drawn to the precise Reconstructionist approach. But Reconstructionism is founded on a commitment to diversity. So a lot of communities where it's the only synagogue in a wider region, they like Reconstructionism because of that open embrace. And especially when I go into those communities where frequently the kids are the only Jewish kids in the class, that's just such a different experience than when you go to a place where the calendar, where things shut down on Friday afternoon, or where the negotiations, if you are oriented toward kashrut, the negotiations in the supermarket are a completely different way of moving through the world.
You know, and you referenced the fact, and I had not known, that you had considered making Aliyah at different points in your life. Tell me if I'm off base here. I think the father of the Reconstructionist movement, Mordechai Kaplan, I think whose 40-year yahrzeit will fall later this November, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. he also had considered at different points living in Israel. In fact, spent, I think, the latter years of his life in Israel proper in Rehavia.
Right. So Kaplan was a passionate Zionist, very involved in most of the Zionist organizations, certainly in the States, and also many of the world Zionist entities. There's a wonderful book by Noam Pienko called Zionism and the Roads Not Taken. He had serious apprehensions about political Zionism for reasons I go into in briefly in my essay, but he loved the idea of, it was very much after Echad Ha'am, a cultural Zionist, and the idea of the concentration and the exponential creativity that could emerge from that concentration of Jews, Jewish thinkers, Jewish living. He actually went to Israel in 1937 to establish the education department at the Hebrew University, and really, I think, would have stayed if the Second World War hadn't kind of converged on them. And his family in the States were so worried about the war coming to what was then Palestine that he came home in 1939. So the trajectory might have been very different if not for a world war. And then he went back at the end of his life. He went back for the last 15 years. He came back here at the very, very end. But he lived a long, well-lived life, and his last vital part was spent in Israel.
100 years, right?
If I'm 101 years. 101 years. God bless.
So I want to go a little bit into his conception of Zionism in a bit, and sort of his belief in the necessity, I think, for Jews. In the 30s, the 40s, and 50s, I think it kind of stood out in contrast, I think, to many of his contemporaries in American Jewry at the time. So if we rolled the tape back to 30s and 40s, you know, some of his contemporaries were apathetic, some were agnostic about the founding of the state, others were opposed, others were concerned. You know, one illustrative case that stands out for me stems from piece that is in Danny Gordas's book, which I don't have the name at the top of my head, but he highlights the story of Rabbi Louis Finkelstein, who in 1951 was placed on the cover of Time magazine, right? The scion of the conservative Jewish movement. And the article called him, quote, definitely a non-Zionist, and noted that the rabbi refused to let students sing the Hatikva, right? Israel's national anthem, at its commencement in 45 and then subsequently in 46. And then 2 years later, the founding of the state in 48, JTS, right? This remarkable institution that's graduated conservative rabbis and chazans for a generation, according to Gordas, refused requests by several faculty members to take out ads in the New York Times celebrating the creation of the first Jewish sovereign state in 2000 years. So, but a decade prior to that, Kaplan wrote in his classic book, right, Judaism as a Civilization, he wrote that, quote, Judaism is unlikely to survive either as an ancillary or coordinate civilization unless it thrives as a primary civilization in Palestine. And then when I saw that quote, it reminded me of a sentence that you wrote in the piece itself, talking about the notion of a primary civilization. So right. Like, what does it mean? What does Kaplan mean? And what kind of distinguished him from, let's say, Theodor Herzl or Ben-Gurion's view of political Zionism?
I so love this question. And I'm like, let me organize my thoughts so that I'm relatively, you know, relatively concise and don't just geek out all over the place.
We could talk for hours about this, but you know, whatever comes to mind.
I so appreciate your preparation also, Hanan. It's really fantastic. Kaplan was part of a larger group of conservative rabbis who were really oriented toward at least cultural Zionism. So he was not alone. He was on the faculty of the Jewish Theological Seminary for more than 50 years. And he was quite isolated and embattled with Finkelstein and other leaders around theology and other things, but not necessarily around Palestine and then Israel. There was a cadre. Kaplan came up with the understanding, so let me do a couple of different things and bring it all together. Kaplan came up with the understanding of Judaism as the evolving religious civilization of the Jewish people in the 20s and the 30s. So the book, his magnum opus, Judaism as a Civilization, came out in 1934, but it was the product of many, many speeches and articles that he wrote. And he put forward this idea of civilization to kind of set aside, there was so much internecine battling in the Jewish community, both in Europe in the years between really since the start of modernity, but especially in the early 20th century, and in the American Jewish community, that there were people who said, Judaism is only a religion. So if you were Orthodox, you said it was maximally only a religion. And then if you were a classical reform, you said it was minimally only a religion in the home. And then you were an American or a German on the street. And then you had like the predominant strand of Zionism were the Eastern European political Zionists who said Judaism is only a political movement. It is now Zionism and religion. There's no room for religion. That's an old idiom that doesn't have a place in modernity. And Kaplan, first of all, understood that there was no central authority, that we were living in a moment of contested authority. Those of us in America were living in a place of democracy. And so in addition to no authoritarianism, God willing, there's also the primary way to make your case in America is persuasiveness. And what the idea of civilization was to put a rest to all of that. It's this, no, it's this, no, it's that, to say it's this and that. A civilization is the land and the people and the religious customs and the mores and the ethics and the food and so on and so on and so on. And that all of them were legitimate entry points into the Jewish community. And that it was the role of the leaders of the Jewish community to try to expand the boundaries as much as possible without lowering any kind of standards. And also civilization, in addition to having that function within the Jewish community, also that this was in the 20s was a moment of time of people talking a lot about the American civilization and how powerful and how important it was. And it put Judaism as a civilization on a par with the American civilization. And what Kaplan really believed is that those of us who lived in a place other than Palestine or Israel, in a place where that we would live in two civilizations, that we should try to, we could be, he had, I like to say a bad math, we could be 100% American and 100% Jewish, and that we could influence, each civilization could influence the other. So that from the Jewish civilization, he wanted, like especially the ethics and the values. And from the American civilization, he was most interested in democracy, many things, but especially democracy and a kind of egalitarianism. And so, the Jewish civilization would be most fully fueled and most fully animated if it were in close relationship with that place where Jews could live in the primary civilization, where all of the reference points, all of the time markers, all of the calendar was primarily Jewish. So instead of, like one of the things I love about America is Thanksgiving, because I celebrate Thanksgiving the same way every other American celebrates Thanksgiving, as opposed to how I might have to negotiate, you know, Rosh Hashanah or Passover. And so that the primary civilization where it is Yom Kippur, everything is shut down on Yom Kippur. And whether you're on your bicycles or whether you're in synagogue, everything is shut down. There's no negotiation that has to happen. So the early Reconstructionists, they understood, they had a logo, and it was like a wheel. They imagined it to be a wheel, and Eretz Yisrael was at the center. They created it before statehood. So Eretz Yisrael is at the center. America, and later on they changed it to diaspora Jewry, was the wheel at the outskirts, and the rims connecting the two of them were Musar, ethics, and Dat, religion, and Tarbut, culture. And what they really imagined was a rich interplay that the primary civilization would especially fuel culture and the richness of like everyday life, and would help to inform the American Jewish experience or the diaspora Jewish experience. And what we American Jews, that huge population in the States, could bring is our systems of democratic governance and what it means, the richness of what we can learn from being a significant minority in a majority culture. And so he always imagined back and forth. I looked in my research, I wrote my dissertation using Reconstruction sources. What did they do? Because as I wrote in the essay, Kaplan was ambivalent about statehood. He was really worried about marrying all the power of the state to religious authority. And that was partly because he had lived through two world wars and he saw what could happen when with all of the resources of a national government, and also because he was deeply, deeply critical of how Catholicism at mid-century was using in those countries where they were, Catholicism was the official religion. And so I was very curious what they did, what they would do with the logo after statehood. And so in before statehood, it was in Hebrew that they would put it on the masthead of the magazine, The Reconstructionist. It was in Hebrew, Eretz Israel, and in English, it said Palestine. And from 1948 onward, it said Eretz Israel in Hebrew, and they just transliterated it, Eretz Israel. They did not adopt Medinat Israel or Israel. They were thrilled. They were so excited, and they were deeply worried. They were also worried that the flag of the Zionist movement, which was based on a Talit and had a Jewish star, they were concerned that was going to be adopted as the flag of Israel, because they knew that there were already non-Jewish residents and there would continue to be non-Jewish residents. And they wondered, they thought that Zionism was uniting of most Jews around the world with notable exceptions. And they didn't want to, they weren't certain there would be the same kind of orientation to the state. And they didn't want to immediately disenfranchise or make into second class citizens, non-Jewish residents, even if they were in the minority.
I want to get to the issue of non-Jewish residents and what it means to be a majority in a country, something that Jews hadn't necessarily experienced in the better part of 2000 years. But it sounds like he believed, as I presume you and others, that there needs to be some type of cooperative relationship between Israeli Jewry or the Israeli government or the Israel, the country, and diaspora Jewry. You know, again, as I was looking through some old resources as well, I came across this keynote speech that he delivered in 1958 at the annual convention of the Rabbinical Assembly of America, right? He's talking in front of some 600 conservative rabbis. And he notes that the state of Israel created a new division between Jews outside of Israel and those living in it. And according to JTA, still around at that time, said something to the effect of, you know, many Jews outside of Israel no longer feel a sense of responsibility for the state, and many Israeli Jews no longer feel a sense of responsibility for Jews who do not migrate to Israel. And he talked about this notion of a disbanded people and ultimately expressed concern that world Jewry is in a precarious state. So on the one hand, he lauded the creation of this state, but also lamented, a series of concern about its impact on world Jewry.
Right. So you mentioned Kaplan's age. Kaplan was born in 1881 and he was born in Europe, and he himself was an immigrant, but his work, both at the Teachers Institute at the Jewish Theological Seminary and in articulating Reconstructionism as an approach, was really about trying to acculturate the children of immigrants. And he looked at he was a magpie. He would use any tool that would help him in that work. There's that story of that immigrants would toss their tefillin into New York Harbor as the Statue of Liberty came into view. And what he was also trying to do was to help these children of immigrants, these moderns, understand that there was a way to harmonize Judaism and modernity. There's a way to harmonize Judaism and living in America. Zionism was one of those ways, and he was really interested in that. But for those who, that was only a partial solution or who weren't interested, that was the bulk of his work. But when he looked at what tools he could use and what inspired him personally, the Zionist movement was unbelievably inspiring to him. It was largely non-existent at his birth. It was the first conference of the World Zionist Organization was tiny. And by the time he was coming into his maturity in the 20s and the 30s, it was a force to be reckoned with. And it had electrified and united Jews around the world in this mandate. And he is so excited at that vitality and that evolution and that activism. And he wanted to bring, he understood Reconstructionism to be Zionistic Judaism. He wanted to bring that kind of energy into religious Judaism as well. So he was thrilled with Zionism and all that it offered and ways that it could make meaning and help contemporary Jews, modern Jews, understand themselves in relationship to themselves and to other people. And he wanted to add in relationship to the divine as well. He strongly opposed David Ben-Gurion's decision to pursue Mamlachtiyut, to pursue statism, which said the only way to be a Zionism was to make Aliyah. He absolutely saw that. So what you were hearing was 10 years later, 12, 10 years later, his making that case. He gave a series of very influential lectures in 1951, sponsored by the Herzl Institute and also by a particular institute, I'm not remembering the name, of the Jewish Theological Seminary. And I'm wondering, I'd have to go back and research this, if some of it was in an effort to influence Finkelstein as well, called A New Zionism. It was six lectures and bound in together to a book called A New Zionism that talked about, now that statehood had been established, what should be the goal of the Zionist movement? And he really saw that it was absolutely about what you just talked about binding together worldwide Jewish peoplehood and using this nascent state to as a resource and as an inspiration to support that, with the presumption that then worldwide Jews around the world would invest back in. And he was deeply, deeply pained. There was a major ideological conference in 1957, and Kaplan and the eminent historian Salo Baron were the only two people who argued against the negation of the diaspora. And there's actually a picture, I found out about that conference because somewhere along the line, I saw a picture of Kaplan standing nose to nose with Ben-Gurion, and they're clearly fighting. And I think it kind of captures that. And so decades later, there's been that turn toward what we're talking about. But in the 30s, 40s, 50s, it was a really big, big divide.
So I want to fast forward to today, and I want to also remind folks, if you have a question, please put it in the Q&A chat. We're going to try to get to it in about 15, 20 minutes or so. I do want to fast forward to today and reference one of the pieces, one of the elements from your piece, right? If it is the case that the two Jewish communities in Israel and the United States account for 85% of world Jewry, and it is the case that in the United States, the non-Orthodox account for 90% of all American Jews, as you talk about in your piece. And I'm not a mathematician, but I mean, it just shows and indicates how important I think the non-Orthodox voice is in the relationship between both countries. You also highlight a series of, quote, pain points for many non-Orthodox Jews. I want to read just a quick passage and get your reaction to, if you can extrapolate on it. You said, the denigration of our seriousness, our commitments, and our choices, repeated efforts to pass legislation negating the legitimacy of our approach to Judaism and questioning our very identities as Jews, barely nominal recognition and funding for non-Orthodox expressions of Judaism by Israeli authorities, these ongoing factors can be deeply alienating to many Jews. And you continue a few sentences later that these dynamics make Israel the place where Jews are supposed to feel safe and free to fully express ourselves seem deeply unwelcoming. I'm sure that was a difficult paragraph to write, I presume. Is it probably an even more difficult feeling to feel? Could you unpack that just a little bit for our audience? Mindful that you're speaking not just as the head of the Reconstructionist movement, but also to your original point as a non-Orthodox religious Jew.
I'm so grateful you raised that one up, and I skimmed the article to see like what are the lines that I think are most important, and I had underlined the one, these dynamics make Israel the place where Jews are supposed to feel most safe and free to fully express ourselves seem deeply unwelcoming. It's so painful. It's so painful. The rhetoric and the promise and the aspiration and what we think can grow under conditions of freedom and without constraint. And for that to be true, absolutely true, there are gorgeous examples and experiments in in Judaism, in Jewish identity, in Israeli identity, increasingly in like an indigenous, in denominational Judaism in Israel, and also in indigenous expressions. Like, so all of that is true. And then also along that is in spite of investment and support, that is in the face of ongoing efforts to disenfranchise, in the face of dismissal or even subjugation oppression? I don't know, but to my understanding of what Israel is supposed to be, it feels completely impossible. It feels contradictory. It feels so very painful. And you know, some of it is attitudinal, people on the street, and some of it is the product of coalition governments and the way that Israeli government functions, where it's a there can be a lurching around, but there is, as I say later in the essay, it seems that there isn't either a full-scale reckoning with, let alone an embrace of those statistics and the aspirations of so many Jews significantly in the diaspora, and I think a growing number within the land of Israel.
So, you know, I was thinking about it, but for two relatively brief periods of time, I want to say when Ehud Barak served as prime minister in 99 to 2001, then 20 years later with the Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid coalition, it is the case that like the right has effectively held power for the better part of the 21st century, right? In fact, really since a brash young upstart name Benjamin Netanyahu assumed the premiership in 96, it's basically been like Likud and Kadima at the helm. Yeah. So if you're an American Jew and you're under the age of 30, and it's more than likely, you're more than likely not Orthodox, you're more than likely not growing up, you're more than likely potentially growing up in some type of intermarried family, you're more than likely unable to speak, read, or understand Hebrew, you're more than likely to have a predominantly progressive orientation and policy outlook. You've never necessarily experienced Israel at the existential brink, like in 48 or 67, possibly 73. Like, you don't have that internal memory. What's to compel a connection to country? There's a counter to that, of course, but I'm curious, you know, to the extent you speak with individuals in your orbit, does that materialize in some way? How does that manifest? Did that conversation take place or not? Again, there's a counter to that, but that's one perspective.
You articulated it so powerfully that is a conversation I have very, very frequently. Frequently, it's about interpreting a younger generation to an older generation who remembers the establishment of the State of Israel or who lived through 67. And I talk about, to put it in personal terms, I started rabbinical school in 1993. And one of the first things we did in the fall of my first year of rabbinical school is we crowded into our Hadar Ki'ilah, our common room, to watch the signing of the Oslo Accords on the White House lawn. So there was a kind of hopefulness. And so I think you're right to like kind of locate it of the dismantling of the Oslo Accords from 1996 onward. I think that you have just articulated very powerfully a combination of forces that has led to a disengagement from Judaism for many, many, not all, but many, many younger Jews. And I'm also hearing from their parents too. This is only growing. And I think that my desperate hope is that Israel will help make that, will shift in ways, will act in ways to help make the case more clearly and more compellingly. The project that the response that I give often is about that this is where more than half the Jews in the world live. Like there's no way that the disengagement really isn't an option. If we really believe Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh B'Zeh, that every Jew is responsible for each other, so that to make certain that we are looking up and outward, that in our universalist orientation, that it arises from a deep place of particularism, and it can't fail to take Israel and Jews who live in Israel alongside Palestinians, alongside non-Jews who live in Israel into consideration, to talk about the agency and the opportunity to have an impact that I spoke about at the beginning when you asked me about Ahavat Israel and what I most love about Israel, to talk about what it is to articulate in a compelling way what Jewish values, what the particular statement of Jewish values is in the postmodern world, full of conflict, full of rising populism and authoritarianism, and to do it in a way that is both conversant with universalism and also still deeply, deeply rooted in Jewish practice and Jewish vision and Jewish aspirations. And Israel has to be a part of that conversation for us to draw most authentically and most powerfully, I think. So it is, it's persuasion for those who are open to it. That can be very, very persuasive. For those who are only reading headlines, it's a harder lift.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious how you would respond to the following. I walked off the stage of a panel discussion last year, and then someone comes up to me, and in the course of the conversation, she says some variation of, American Jews don't really have a right to criticize Israel or its government. Like, if we American Jews want to make a difference in the country, you know what we should do? Make Aliyah.
Yeah.
Right. Become immersed in like the democratic experiment. Easy, you know, to cast stones from, you know, the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. But like, unless you, not you, but like, unless one moves to Israel, don't criticize them. Our job, she said to me, was like, you know, they have very few friends. Our job is to defend the country. That's our responsibility. And she was essentially making an argument that Michael Koplow had written about in the New Republic in 2018. During that time in 2018, there's a lot of discussion about the great divide between American Jews and Israel. And he highlighted the fact that, you know, American Jews rightly feel a stake in Israel, but, you know, from a certain perspective, they want to heed their directives, even though, you know, American Jews don't live there, don't pay taxes there, don't perform mandatory military service there. So if you really want to, you know, a stake in the conversation, you got to make Aliyah. But for that, you really don't have a voice. How would you respond? Like, if you were sitting in my shoes, and again, it was different for me because I was a government official and I could talk about it specifically through that lens. But like, have you been on the receiving end of that question in the past?
Oh, sure. Many. I mean, always. I mean, I think even when I was the first time my family lived in Israel was when I was 12. You know, I lived there before my bat mitzvah in high school and college and rabbinical school. So even before I became politically active or a movement leader, that feels like it's a longstanding refrain. And I think for you, as a former government official, thinking about like the funding that the US government might give Israel, That feels to me like a completely different conversation than just like the private individual, either just as that private individual or in my rabbinic role or my movement leadership role. That feels like a really different orientation. I feel like on the one hand, I totally get it. I think the most, and I had this conversation with a colleague of mine who I was in rabbinical school with and who made Aliyah immediately after. And she's on the board of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical Association. And we had this conversation last week at the board meeting. There is, I think, the most complete and the most impactful way to make a difference is by making Aliyah. Do I think it's the only way? Do I think that otherwise it's hands off or whatever the government? I don't equate Medinat Yisrael with Eretz Yisrael with Am Yisrael. I don't, even as successive governments have been largely largely moving to the right. I don't believe that it, with the coalition arrangement, I don't think that this government is reflective of a mandate. I think it's a cobbled together coalition. And so therefore, I do think that there is an opportunity to weigh in. Do I think it carries the same weight? No. Do I think it is my role is, or my only space is to shut up and not say anything? No, I don't think that is all. I also don't think that criticism of Israel is co-equal with anti-Zionism, which is co-equal with anti-Semitism. And I think that there are deep problems like the suppression of the human rights of other, I think what is going on in the West Bank is highly, highly problematic, that there's a huge population that is living without rights, and that challenges Israel's claim to be a democratic. Israel has most control over people who have no rights, and that's a problem, and calls into question democratic commitments, and I am enacting Ohev Yisrael, Avat Yisrael. I am being Ohev Yisrael in raising up those concerns and those criticisms. So is it the same as a citizen? Is no. But is am I deeply in relationship? Absolutely. And so I think to do it from a place of Avat Yisrael, first and foremost, to put forward that Israel's well-being and Israel's future is always at the forefront of my thought. And do I think so? Therefore, it should be the way Deborah Waxman sees. No, by no means. But to be the voice of among the raucous and diverse Jewish people, that feels really, really important. And I do think that the title of this essay suggests that, like Kaplan in 1958, like I am really worried that there's a schism that, there's separation, which I don't think is good for the Jews, but if there's conflict, and if there's, many of the essays reference Sina Chinam, reference causeless hatred in this issue, and whether or not that the two previous Jewish commonwealths didn't survive more than 70 years. And I do think that the diaspora Israeli divide is of a piece with some of what's really roiling in Israel right now. And having spent time there in November and time there in April, I heard Israeli after Israeli after Israeli, from Yair Lapid to Israelis on the streets, say, "We need your voices. Please do not be silent." So that was also the first time that to really hear it invited in.
Which is such a rarity, all right? I don't recall that necessarily being the case, right? Oftentimes, these issues stop at the water edge, so to speak. Sam Hillard had written earlier, and I did not seen it until now. He basically asked a similar question, saying, "I'm a strong supporter of the state of Israel, and I'm against much of the judicial bill, but I question why anyone who doesn't live in Israel has a right to intervene in Israeli politics." I want to ask one more question, then let's open it up to the floor. This is, sort of a derivation of the type of question I just asked. I recall distinctly, it was early part of this century, and a rabbi from Efrat came to my synagogue during the height of the Second Intifada. And he said, he got up there at the pulpit and he's speaking in front of a packed audience. And he said that if Israel is Disneyland, okay. But if Israel is your motherland, then in the time of need, you need to do what you can to protect her. And the irony, as I've thought about it, is that I grew up, and I presume a lot of American Jews grew up with a quote unquote actual Disneyland version of Israel, with like a, an Eretz Zavat Chalav Udavash, a land of milk and honey version of Israel, an Exodus version of Israel. And Mati Friedman, who's graced these pages as well, he wrote in The Atlantic a couple years ago, when looking at the Exodus, he said the novel isn't just a fantasy about Israel, as I'd remembered, or even primarily that. It's about America. Exodus says, like he says, Exodus says less about the country where it's set than about an American tendency, one very much in evidence this month. He was referring to the pitched battles between Hamas and Israel, to imagine people here in Israel as a reflection of themselves. And I wonder to what extent whether American Jews actually do that too frequently, where we lose ourselves, you know, in our criticism or not. Yes, there's an occupation that's been around for decades, to which you highlighted. And there are all the challenges of what it means to be in power in a state. But I wonder to what extent you would agree or disagree with it, with that sentiment.
I do agree completely. I feel like way too often, like maybe 90% of the time when American Jews are talking about Israel, we're actually talking about ourselves. And there, it is so much an exercise in projection. I will also say that Israeli Hasbara has contributed to that. And that definitely, you know, there's like, I can't remember the name of this famous Israeli movie of like, where it's from the 70s, where like Americans from abroad came to see the trees that they planted, and they just have a forest and they just keep switching out the names, the same forest, but they keep switching out the names. Like, I think that definitely in Israel's early years, for many, many reasons, the fostering of an idealization secured a relationship much more than a more authentic relationship. I will tell you one of the most painful stories of my rabbinic career. Very early on, is I was finishing rabbinical school. I had a student pulpit in, I won't name the place, but in the center of the country. You do not live there if you want a robust Jewish community. In fact, there were folks who had moved there from Chicago and moved back because the Jewish community was too thin. And this man had an in-law suite in his place. It was a resort community, and an in-law suite, and I would stay there for my visits. And he went to Israel for the first time. He was in his 50s, and he was devastated. He hated it because it was something other than what the posters were like and what he'd been taught about in Hebrew school. And he and I grew up in the same hometown. I knew the education he had gotten, even though we had both traveled great distances. And he could not handle, he said the Israelis were rude and the weather was hot. And like he encountered Israel in its reality and it shattered him. And he couldn't see like, oh, this is maturity. Oh, this is authenticity. He felt betrayed, but the betrayal wasn't, oh, I got this Pollyanna-ish education. It was, I don't want anything more to do with Israel. It was so hard to like, to help him move beyond it. It was so broken for him. And I feel like the whether or not people make Aliyah, whether or not I make Aliyah, whether or not other people make Aliyah, I do everything I possibly can to get people to go to Israel and to be with Israelis, not to just go to Masada, not to just go to the Kotel, but to go and like sit and talk and learn and hear and live with the complexity, and that I feel is helps, at least for a little while, helps me to break out of my, oh, I'm really talking about the American Jewish community. Oh, like, you know, and that's one of the reasons I became a rabbi, is because once I made the decision in my 20s not to make Aliyah, I part of the draw of the rabbinate was that it would keep me in deep relationship with Israel. It would keep it front and center in my mind. It would give me pretext and opportunity to travel there as often as I.
Well, listen, I have a lot of follow-ups there, but I'm going to zip it, and it's because there are a lot of questions, and I want to just delve right into one immediately. Rabbi Waxman, sometimes it feels like criticism of Israel from the Jewish left sounds a lot like the same critiques that are coming from anti-Israel voices, where criticism from the right feels more like it's within the family. Do you think that's a fair critique?
I haven't heard a ton of criticism from the right until recent months. I do think that the judicial reforms, and in Israel, you know, they use the term mahapah, like they use revolution, that the current crisis that started since early January is remaking critique and support both in Israel and in America. So I understand the question. I'm not so familiar with critique. I think that from the right, it's mostly what you put forward, which is your job is to support Israel, whatever is going on in Israel, that this is a dangerous neighborhood and Israel's unfairly singled out. I do understand that, I mean, I identify fiercely as a progressive Zionist. I feel that that's a deep inheritance from Kaplan to this day. And I do hear that sometimes what the concerns and the critique that I, as a representative of a progressive Zionist camp, offers is of a piece, has a connection to folks who identify as anti-Zionists. And that's for me, I feel that the way to keep it in the family is by grounding that critique in Ahavat Yisrael, maintaining deep and abiding relationships with Israelis, listening to their voices first and foremost before I speak, spending as much time as I possibly can in Israel. That's my choice, and I'm in a position to be able to do it. I try to offer that as a model and create as many opportunities for others. And I try to also call out folks on the left who I think are unfair or prejudiced or anti-Semitic. That feels like an essential part of this project of loving critique.
It's kind of building on that. A certain Scott Lisensky said, I want to ask less about the essay and its main points and focus on the overarching question of dissent. For many Jews, notions of quote unquote Jewish peoplehood and mainstream Israel discourse carry an expectation for intellectual conformity. Rather than reflecting conformity and deference, your essay displays openness and critical engagement. What will it take for more Jewish leaders and Jewish quote unquote spaces to be comfortable hosting and sponsoring such perspectives?
Scott, I so appreciate that question, and thanks for raising it up, Hanan. And Scott is very involved in building up a sense of Jewish peoplehood. So again, not to geek out too much, but the word peoplehood, not the concept of Am Yisrael, but the word peoplehood, the Reconstructionists helped to bring it to speech. In that same period, when in the 30s and the 40s, after Kaplan put forward the idea of Judaism as the evolving religious civilization of the Jewish people, it wasn't catching on. It didn't have the impact that he wanted it to have. And he understood that there were like rhetorical problems, a longstanding problem of the Reconstructionist movement, too many words, maybe too much nuance, which is part of the answer to this question. And so there was a conference in 1942 of Reconstructionists about how to get out the core, not so much the definition or the ideology, but the activism and the agency and the ownership of reconstructing Judaism that they were trying to put forward. And the stakes were very, very high. They didn't understand the extent of what was going on in Europe, but they knew it was very, very bad. And they understood that the American Jewish community was going to step forward into leadership in an unprecedented way. And the state of Israel was still a wild, even as there were many, many Zionists, it was still a wild prospect, a completely unimaginable prospect. And they were trying to talk about, they realized that civilization, it's a kind of a, it's a noun, and it embeds everything that I talked about earlier, but it didn't necessarily have the warmth or the sense of obligation that they were trying to cultivate. And they threw out different words that maybe would communicate it better. And one of them was this idea of peoplehood, this idea of transnational, of connection across geographic lines and also across time, that we were connected to the people who came before us and that we have connections to the people who will follow us. And they thought, oh, peoplehood might work, and they started to use it, and it leapt pretty quickly into the Jewish lexicon, and it leapt into the first instance of it in the American lexicon was in 1961. It came out in American Heritage Dictionary, and Ira Eisenstein, who was Kaplan's son-in-law and his successor, called up and they said, oh, it's from the Reconstructionists. It's from one of Kaplan's big birthday celebrations. But they intended peoplehood as a means to an end. They intended peoplehood as being about mutual obligation across differences, about intellectual openness and critical engagement. They wanted that to be the basis and the starting line for everything that followed. And one of the challenges that all of us face is that American Jews, for sure, And is secular Israeli Jews, in a different way, latched onto the concept of peoplehood, but as an end rather than as a means. And so it is our task, I think, like what some folks have argued, like set aside the idea of peoplehood, it's too dated, it doesn't work. I don't hear that critique as much as I used to in the face of rising anti-Semitism, which is really, really, really interesting. My response, I think, is to invest it with meaning. And that meaning, the thing is to go back to that idea that we are living in an age of contested authority. No one person, even the Israeli government, can tell us how it is to be Jewish. So it's got to be about understanding that your way of being Jewish is not the same as way of my being as Jewish, is not the same as a secular Israeli on the street versus a religious Israeli in the synagogue. And that, so it has to be about engagement and curiosity and complexity and nuance. And I think that that's an incredibly important, I think that that's Israel, and in its core diversity, does that very well in some ways and really problematically in other ways. And I think it's a growing edge for the American Jewish community.
Speaking of the American Jewish community, why do you think it's the case, and Pew polls bear this out, that the Orthodox community are far more emotionally attached to Israel than, let's say, those of no particular branch, right? It's like some 82% in the Orthodox and like 40% in no particular branch. And those individuals who are older are typically more connected emotionally to Israel than younger.
We talked about the older a little bit, but about still, like, I think that, I mean, the Orthodox, it's a matter of priorities and how they organize their lives, that I think many Orthodox Jews send their kids to day school where Israel is a part of the curriculum in a particular way. Many Orthodox Jews, when they graduate from high school, take a gap year and they do some kind of either learning or service project in Israel. And, you know, there's some like Habonim and Young Judea and Hashem Ratzir, there are those options for secular Jews as well, but it's in much larger percentages. I think, you know, there, I know that, you know, for my friends who keep very strictly kosher, I mean, I eat hot out. My friends, meaning I will eat in a non-kosher restaurant. My friends who keep a more strict level of kashrut, like, it's just liberating to be in Israel and you can go to not every restaurant, but most, so I think it's just, there's more of a draw and an orientation to spending discretionary dollars there. So I think it is a matter of priorities.
Right, okay, one or two more questions and then we're gonna wrap because it is 1 o'clock. Don Shapiro writes, as a Jew, I feel that the non-Jewish world expects us to be responsible for Israel's conduct, both good and bad, as opposed to how my German or Italian friends are not expected to have that same sense of responsibility for the sovereign state that is Germany and Italy. Can you comment on that? Is it inherently anti-Semitic, for example, or philo-Semitic for, you know, certain individuals to immediately associate, and this is not him, this is my words, you know, a Jew with Israel per se for good and for ill?
I think it's very, I appreciate my dear friend Don's question. And I think it's mushy. I mean, I think I was gonna say we want it both ways, but I don't think that's so accurate. I think we do feel this, and I'm arguing for this intense connection, but is it mandatory? Is it obligatory? Must everybody feel as invested in Israel's future as I do? I think my commitment to diversity says no. I'm not convinced that you can live a Jewish life completely unconnected from Israel, but I'm not gonna say to someone you shouldn't try. I remember I was in Pittsburgh right after the terrible shooting there in 2018, and Naftali Bennett came and claimed Israel as the protector for the American Jews in ways that was very confusing and fuzzy, and Netanyahu has done the same. I think that there is the another thing that Reconstructionism set out to do is to answer the questions of is Judaism a religion? Is it a culture? Is it a political theory? And the answer, the Reconstructionist answer is yes. Yes, it's all of those things that you don't have to choose between them, but that's confusing to us. And it's even more confusing to non-Jews. And so is it fair? Appropriate? I don't know. I think the most important thing for us to do is to sort our own sense of those obligations. I do think that there are times when it absolutely crosses the line into anti-Semitism or into an unfair scrutiny or set of expectations when Israel is singled out for human rights abuses that are rampant across the world and only Israel is focused. I think that is a little bit different than, I mean, whether when Don says non-Jewish world, is he talking about governments or organizations like Amnesty International, or is he talking about individuals in conversation on the street? I do think that the thing we can most powerfully do is understand our own commitments, understand our own aspirations, and then prioritize them. And that will help us in our response to them to say, you know, yes, these are the ways that we are intertwined, and no, these are the ways that these are we are separate and we are distinct.
Rabbi Waxman, final question. Your successor, X amount of years from now, joins a Sapir podcast or webinar or conversation or the like. What will you hope to have been the case by then that is not the case now in terms of the dialectic relationship between American Jewry and the state of Israel?
What a question. It is my hope, first and foremost, that non-Orthodox expressions of Judaism, religious Judaism, are flourishing in Israel with and without state funding, and that that the American Jewish community, with or without support from the Israeli government, has invested significantly in our own Jewish content, our own Jewish identity, our own Jewish richness, and that the two communities are in rich interchange between and in a way that feels enlivening and growthful and mutually supportive.
If you haven't yet had a chance to read Rabbi Waxman's essay and all of the essays in Sapir, I encourage you to go to sapirjournal.org to read, to print, etc. And please join me in a virtual round of applause for Rabbi Waxman. We so appreciate you joining us today and very much looking forward to continuing the conversation.